Judiciary Committee will come to order. It is 1:37 on the afternoon of Friday, February 15th, 2008. We have a quorum here to conduct business. Senator McGuire is here, Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator French. We've got two bills up on the agenda today, one which should only take a few minutes and the other will take a little bit longer. Let's first bring back a bill we heard on Wednesday, or it might have been on Monday, I'm sorry, it was on Monday, SB 211 by Senator Betty Davis, an act relating to aggravating factor sentencing for crimes directed at a victim because of the victim's homelessness. We heard the bill and had a good presentation from the bill's sponsor during that hearing. There were we basically held the bill over because of to just give a little more thought to the idea of whether we needed to define the term homelessness. I'm personally convinced by the testimony we had at the last hearing that it's a term that juries will just understand. A dictionary definition, I think, will work. And while Senator Wilikowski and Senator Huggins made some good points about some of the potential difficulties of, you know, defining this crime and some difficult circumstances under which it may be attempted to be prosecuted, I think, you know, the paradigmatic case is one we can all sort of understand. It sort of springs out of the paintball attacks from several years ago here in Anchorage, and I think this is a good way to get at it in sort of a surgical method. So that's my view of the bill. Other discussions by members of the committee? Don't hear or see any. We closed public testimony during the last hearing, so is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, with regard to SB 211, I would move that we move the bill onto the next committee with individual recommendations and any accompanying fiscal notes.
So it's a zero fiscal note. Without objection, the bill is moved. Next up, and a little weightier, and with a little more substance, is HB 197. And I see the bill's sponsor here in the room, Representative Ramirez, my counterpart in the House. Very pleasant to see you here this afternoon with your able staff. If you'd put yourself on the record, we'd be happy to hear your introductory remarks with respect to this bill.
Thank you, Senator French, and members of the Senate Judiciary, and thank God for my able staff, because this is a little bit of an esoteric bill. This is another bill on trusts, and Senator French, when Senator McGuire was in the lower body as the Judiciary Chair, she handled a number of these trust bills that continue to make Alaska one of a very few states that can take on unique trust issues, and it makes Alaska more attractive than just for cold climate testing, which is desirable for Alaska to enjoy uniqueness for things other than our geography or climate. In this case, this bill proposes a number of default provisions for trustees that have not previously existed in our statute. With that, Mr. Chairman, we are hosting the Judiciary hearing on the same child predator issues that you and I were talking about in the hallway that some of the members on the Senate side saw this morning. I'm going to go back down and continue that activity with Special Agent Waters, and would look forward to writing a letter with the Senate Judiciary Committee, precisely the issue that we talked about, which was beefing up or looking to beef up state resources for online predators. It's as we said out in the hallway, it's you tend to have an anecdotal look at it because of the way NBC does those male buffoons in To Catch a Predator, but clearly it's a much more of an epidemic in the computer system. It's not just eBay that poses a hazard, but it's a broader risk that we all are subjected to. So with that, if you'll excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I'd be grateful to turn it over to Jane Pearson and to the experts in the room on trust law.
I promise that we'll treat HB 197 gently in your absence, Representative.
Thank you, Mr.
Nice
Chair.
To see you.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Senator French, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. There are.
Can you give us your name just for the record?
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson. I'm staff to Representative Jay Ramirez. And this is a bill that there really are experts that have worked on this bill very hard. And for me to talk about it will not do it justice that they can do it. So I think questions should really be directed to them.
Fair enough. Any questions for Ms. Pearson while we have her on the hot seat about a difficult area of the law? Hearing and seeing none, thank you for being here. I assume you'll be watching over us carefully. We do have some folks both in the room and online to testify. We'll start with the live witnesses. Mr. Blockmacher, nice to see you here. Let the record reflect that Senator Terrio has joined us. Please come forward, put yourself on the record. We all know who you are, but go ahead and give us your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Douglas Blockmacher, and I'm president of Alaska Trust Company. Over the last year and a half, we've done extensive work on House Bill 197, and we support it. And as far as we know, there's no opposition to it. We think it's a good bill and continues to move Alaska forward as one of the premier trust jurisdictions.
Excellent. Questions for Mr. Blockmacher, Senator?
And maybe for another way, at some point, can we have someone kind of walk us through and just tell us what exactly this does?
That's certainly my wish. And Mr. Blockmacher, I don't know whether Ms. Chapman is here to do that or she's nodding her head. So thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And Ms. Chapman, it looks like you're the one who's going to put this into plain English for us.
Hi.
Nice to see you this afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Beth Chapman. I'm an attorney at the law firm of Faulkner Banfield here in Juneau, and I have practiced in the trust and estates area for the last 20 years. And I have been principally involved in drafting House Bill 197, and will be glad to walk through this bill. Before I do, I want to indicate this bill has been discussed by estate planning attorneys around the state and was the subject of some pretty vigorous discussion. And I think that many issues, both from the perspective of beneficiaries and trustees and settlers, those who established the trust, have been vetted and compromises have been reached that really protects all the interests of the parties to a trust. I will go through it section by section, which is probably the easiest way to do this. Section one is, as you may know, a lot of individuals establish revocable trusts, which are trusts that are established by an individual, but they can revoke it, but they put their assets in this trust for a variety of purposes in the event they become disabled. The trustee could handle the assets for them, and also to pass the assets without the need of probate at their death. Many professionals use this, and they own shares in a professional corporation, and this would just clarify that those professional corporation shares can, in fact, be held by a revocable trust. This would have no effect on any creditors' abilities to access those shares because a revocable trust does not, in and of itself, provide creditor protection. So it would not change the ability of those shares to be subject to a debt or a liability of the professional. Section 2 through 8 is really...
Ms. Chapman,
excuse me.
Senator Wilikowski has a question.
It's been a long, long time since I've done anything with trusts. I chose to put that completely out of my head after the bar exam. Can you just kind of break that down? I mean, what does Section 1 do? What's the real implications? Maybe a little bit simpler terms.
Okay. Senator Wilichowski, through the chair, what Section 1 does is currently professional corporation shares can only be held by professionals because of the laws that surround, for example, you know, a professional who might have a lawyer. Let's take a lawyer who has a professional corporation. If they form it, they have to own their shares. They can't give it to their children or to their spouse. And they are personally liable, of course, for any of their malpractice. They don't get that corporate shield for their own personal malpractice. If we have a professional that wants to set up a revocable trust for estate planning purposes, they cannot currently hold those professional shares in that revocable trust for estate planning purposes. This would just simply allow that to occur, and for all practical purposes, the revocable trust and the individual are considered the same. So it just allows this mechanism to happen so that if they become incapacitated, somebody can handle their affairs, including handling maybe winding up that professional corporation without the need to go to court for a conservator, and would allow them to liquidate it and pass on to their heirs without the need for a probate, which is why most people use revocable trusts.
Senator Wilikowski.
And then if, let's say someone sets up a professional corporation and then gives the bulk of its shares to someone, to a revocable trust, do you get into issues about liability or in piercing the trust in order to get Are there any kind of liability issues like that?
Through the chair, no, there's no liability issues there at all, because those shares would still be subject to the creditors of the owner of the professional corporation. There would be no issue involved. It is, all of us recognize that if you set up a revocable trust, you're not obtaining any creditor protection at all. That's not their purpose.
So this isn't setting up any type of shield?
Absolutely no.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Chapman. Please proceed.
Sections 2 through 8 are the default provisions addressing trustees. Currently, we do not have on the books of the laws of the state of Alaska any rules regarding the removal, replacement, compensation of trustees, or how co-trustees are to act. It's very limited. It's sort of just never been addressed. And these provisions would add default provisions. So if you had an individual who drafts a trust that did not contain these provisions, then they would have default provisions which would be read into the trust and will provide more efficient administration of the trust. Going through each section, Section 2, effective failure to register, this is just a reference that if there is going to be a removal of a trustee for failing to register a trust, it would be done so under the now newly adopted removal procedures. Section 3 is the same. It's just a cross-reference that the court has the jurisdiction to appoint and remove a trustee, and now would reference the new procedure that would be in place. Section 4 does the same, just a reference to what would be now considered 1336.076. And starting in Section 5 are the new provisions. And 1336.055, the statute has always allowed a trustee to be paid what is deemed reasonable compensation. And this provision would would provide that if the trust specifies how compensation is to be determined, that that's going to be presumed to be reasonable, because that's what the person who established the trust wanted. Say they wanted to pay their trustee $1,000 a month, the court will presume that to be reasonable. That doesn't mean that a beneficiary who thinks it's unreasonable can't go to court and try to reduce or eliminate that compensation. They would do so and would have to prove that it's unreasonable by a preponderance of the evidence.
Ms. Chapman, one question there. I have a question Senator Wilkowski does also. Let me just ask you, is this based on model legislation? Is this based on a model act?
Some of it is, and some of it is based on a compilation of a review of other state laws. The bulk of these default provisions came from the Uniform Trust Code, with some modifications after looking at what other states had done with the Uniform Trust Code as well. But yes, the bulk of it did come from the Uniform Trust
Code. And I guess I was specifically referring to this subsection, this Section 5.
It
seems to be constructed that way. It seems to be a sort of a series of, you know, logical sentences, each playing into the next. I just thought, well, you know, maybe this got pulled out of a uniform.
No, this one in particular was written by the Alaska attorneys.
Well, it's really well crafted.
Well, thank you.
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
The section that says, well, there's a couple of different sentences, but in particular that say, basically, if a trustee is compensated according to terms set up in the trust, that's presumed to be reasonable. I'm just wondering if I'm just trying to think of situations. I don't know enough about trust to even contemplate this, but if a situation was set up and a trustee was compensated at some outrageous amount, $1,000, $2,000 an hour. I'm wondering how that would impact the beneficiaries. I mean, they'd be using up the funds of the trust, and then yet it'd be presumed to be reasonable. So, I mean, was there discussion of that? Is there concern over that?
Through the chair, yes, there was discussion of that. What was discovered is what we're talking about here. The only time it's presumed reasonable is if the person who established the trust said, "I want to pay this trustee $1,000, I don't know anybody would put $1,000 an hour in, but let's just say $1,000 a month or a week.
Who knows?
And so it's when somebody, the person who wrote the trust, who established it, who put their money in it to express their intent, and when they set out what their intent is, that's what's presumed to be reasonable. If a trust didn't say anything about compensation, other than it needs to be reasonable, or maybe doesn't even say anything at all, then there would be no presumption. There's only a presumption as to what the settlor may have put in that trust. And it still can be overturned by a preponderance of the evidence standard.
Thank you.
Section 6, dealing with accepting or rejecting trusteeship, this just lays out the procedures for how a trustee would say, yes, I'm willing to serve in this role. One method is by accepting the property. Another method is by accepting it in writing and notifying the settlor or the beneficiary that they would, in fact, be accept the duties of trusteeship. And it allows an individual to, who's designated as a trustee, to investigate trust property regarding potential liabilities. And this comes up when we put certain assets in trust, maybe property that has a liquor store on it or undercover oil, underground oil tanks, without actually accepting the duties of the trusteeship. So they can make a reasoned determination as to whether or not they want to assume the role of a trustee. And this is a brand new provision, does not amend any statute that we currently have.
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
If a person designated as a trustee takes no action at all, what would happen in that case?
In a different section, we'll get to Senator Wilkowski. We'll talk about what will happen, which is there's a procedure for appointing the successor trustee, and including going to court if necessary, because there's nobody in line to accept that role.
But if they don't, what's the timeline for that? Let's say someone is designated as trustee. 30 days later, something happens which potentially causes the trustee liability. Is there a scenario set up for that?
Give me one moment. Through the chair, the statute just uses reasonable time, and that the reason for that is because sometimes it takes us a while to maybe locate an individual. They want to have the ability to investigate the assets and the circumstances to make sure they want to do so. So the statute just uses the term reasonable time. 1336072 regarding co-trustees. Many times a trust will appoint two individuals to act as a co-trustee, but it won't indicate whether they have to act by unanimous consent or whether by, if there's only two, obviously not by majority, but if there's three co-trustees, then can they act by majority decision? And this allows the co-trustees to decide to act by majority rather than by unanimous decision. It also allows a co-trustee to delegate the authority, their authority, to another trustee, which can be very important if we have individual trustees, which most trusts have individual trustees, not corporate trustees, if they're going to be out of town or if the other co-trustee may have some particular expertise. 1336073 is a new provision regarding vacancy in trusteeship and appointment of successor. It sets out the circumstances under which we would have to appoint a new trustee when there's a vacancy, whether they have rejected it, we can't find them, they die, or one that I think is important, which is subsection 6, if a guardian or conservator is appointed for an individual serving as a trustee. It has been very unclear under Alaska law what happens if the trustee becomes incapacitated and the guardian steps in. Does the guardian assume the role as a trustee? And I have personally been involved in litigation regarding that where there was significant abuse. And I think it's very important that the fact that they're appointed should cause vacancy, because the settlor didn't appoint the guardian. They appointed this individual as the trustee. So I find that to be a very important clarification of the law. Also clarifies how this vacancy will be filled. First, we're always going to look to the terms of the trust. I think that's an overriding consideration in this bill, is that what the settlor puts in the trust is going to govern. If not, then we are going to allow the beneficiaries, what we call qualified beneficiaries, which are beneficiaries that are going to be receiving or are eligible to receive a distribution from the trust. They can appoint the trustees, so we're giving them rights to do so, except they can't appoint one of themselves as the trustee. Or if not, then the court will appoint an individual or a corporate trustee. If it's a charitable trust, then it is going, this provision would allow the charitable organizations that are designated to receive distributions to also be involved in deciding who would be the successor trustee. Most trusts are written with successors, you know, named in the document, but we find that a lot of individuals write trusts based on forms. They don't seek competent counsel, and these provisions are going to help those individuals in particular when we have to interpret those trusts. The 1336074 dealing with resignation of a trustee. Here, they do need to give 30 days notice if they want to resign, or they can do so with the approval of the court. It's very important that provision states that just because a trustee resigns does not mean they're discharged from their obligations and liabilities, and that they would have to go through the normal court course of wrapping up their responsibilities for the trust. The removal of trustee 1336076 was probably one of the more controversial provisions, and really came up with a provision I think that works the best for protecting the settlors' intent of who they decided would be the trustees, so they're not constantly being threatened with removal by beneficiaries who may not like their decisions for a variety of reasons, and also protects beneficiaries so that if there are serious issues, beneficiaries have rights to remove a trustee. And there's two different procedures. We have a provision for what's called a trust protector, which is an individual you can appoint to oversee the trustee. If we have a trust protector, then their decision is the first in line for removal, and then you would go down all the way down to invoking the court's jurisdiction if necessary. The 1336077 is just simply indicating that the resigned or removed trustee who resigns or removes has to, you know, deliver the trust property as soon as possible to either a co-trustee or a successor trustee. Reimbursement of expenses in 1336078, this one I double-checked, really did come straight from the Uniform Trust Code because I looked at that this morning. And subsection B is the unique provision. A trustee that expends their own funds, of course, on behalf of a trust is reimbursed for those reasonable expenses. But even if a court were to find that expenses were not properly incurred, the Uniform Trust Code took the position that a trustee should be reimbursed expenses if it would result in unjust enrichment to the trust. So even though they may not have been, it may not have been proper for them to expend funds, but if the trust benefited as a result of that, that the trust should not, as a result, be unjustly enriched, such that the trust beneficiaries are benefiting by what might be just a mistake in the way the expenses were incurred.
Ms. Chapman, maybe you see the puzzled look on my face. I'm just trying to figure out how the trust would get unjustly enriched by an expense having been paid out of it to cover something that someone else took care of.
Chairman French,
something along the lines of an example would help me.
Well, I anticipated that question, so I actually pulled out the Uniform Trust Code on this one. It would be a situation where maybe a trustee went out and expended funds to purchase property, and that property is now owned by the trust, and they used their own funds, and they wanted to get reimbursed, and titled it in the name of the trust. Well, they weren't supposed to be able to go out and buy that particular piece of property, maybe pursuant to the terms of the trust. Trust is owning the property. The trustee's out the money. So this is saying that you would reimburse that fund because otherwise the trustee's mistake has enriched the trust.
I see. And thank you. Let the record reflect that Senator Huggins has joined us. Senator Huggins, we're on page 8 of HB 197, working our way through some thrilling trust provisions. Please proceed.
Thank you. 1336079, certification of trust. This is a provision that those of us who are work with banks, brokerage houses, or even real estate title companies, many times we have to demonstrate that the trustee has the authority to take the action that they're going to take. But the trust also contains people, the settlors' dispositive provisions. What's going to happen when they die? They don't want people to know that. They don't want to share that information. And this provision would allow us to instead furnish a certification of the trust, which we all do in practice anyways. And that certification would highlight what the powers are of the trustee, who's the settlor, the tax identification number, and would allow us to give excerpts of those provisions alone, but would prevent some brokerage house or title company from saying, I want the entire trust, even though many of the provisions will only become effective at the death of the settlor and can be changed because it's a revocable trust, and they'd want that to be kept private just like they would with their last will and testament. And this has been the practice and has been accepted by most banks and brokerage houses, but not by all. And so we felt that it would be very important along the lines of the Uniform Trust Code to have on the books statutory authority to use trust certifications. The last section, that covers all of the trustee sections. And Section 9 is dealing with an amendment to a statute that we've had for quite a few years, which allows a trustee to...
Did we skip over Section 8?
I'm sorry, we did.
That's okay. Yep, please, thank you.
I apologize. Section 8 is, again, that's just correcting a reference so that if...
To the removal.
To the removal statute. Procedure, that's yes. Correct. Yep. Thank you, Chairman French. Moving on to Section 9, this amendment... amends a statute that we've had that allows a trustee who has the discretion to distribute assets out of a trust to put those assets, instead of giving them to an individual outright, into another trust, so that maybe they want to extend the terms of the trust. This has been, I have used this for several of my clients who have children with disabilities. The trust is going to terminate. They would receive these assets outright. That would not be in the beneficiary's best interest. And instead, we have moved them to a new trust, same terms, but continuing to keep it under the control of the trustee to protect the beneficiary. And what this amendment does is it would allow individuals from outside of Alaska to move trusts to Alaska, which has always been part of the goals of all of our trust laws, to bring business here, by having an Alaska trustee. And so it's just a provision that should bring more trust business to this state, but has no other substantive changes to that statute. Section 10, again, is just a reference to the removal procedure so that if there is a violation by a trustee of any of the statutory requirements, that they could be removed under that procedure that we have outlined in 1336.076. Section 11 is our definition of qualified beneficiaries for all of the trustee provisions, and it would include those beneficiaries who are entitled or eligible to receive a distribution of income or principal, and those that would receive it if the event causing the trust termination occurs. So it's going to bring remainder beneficiaries, those who are to receive it, when the primary beneficiary were to die, which is usually the case. We set up a trust for the mother's death, it goes to the children. Those children would have these rights under the statute, as would the mother in that example. Section 12 shifts to a completely different topic and deals with charitable trusts. And what it allows is when we adopted the Uniform Principal and Income Act in 2003, we also adopted the provision for charitable trusts and other trusts as well to be able to define income by reference to a percentage of the value of the trust rather than what we normally would consider income. So when we consider income, we look at what's the interest earned on bank accounts, what are the dividends on the stock account, and that's what's going to be distributed to the beneficiaries. And as a result, trustees who have to distribute what is known as traditional income, what we all think of as income, has to invest it very conservatively. They can't really look to grow the trust because they're having to generate all of this income to pay out. And charitable trusts in particular are usually perpetual. They're usually there for the long term, and they benefit only charities. And when you have only income distributions to charities, what's happening is they're getting very little because the trustees are not able to grow the principal, and therefore it becomes not as beneficial to the charitable organizations.
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
I didn't mean to.
That's okay.
You stopped in mid-sentence. This looks like a pretty significant change to me. And it looks like it's moving from what is currently probably a very conservative approach to an approach that allows quite a bit of change, potentially. Is this in line, I guess, is this from the model statute, or is this in line with what other states do?
Through the chair, yes, it is. It's very much in line with what other states have done. And there has been a move in the in trust investments to move from the traditional investment policy, and Mr. Blotmacher can explain that much better than I can, to what's called a total return investment strategy, where you don't just invest for income, or you don't just invest for growth, but you're trying to invest for both. Because if you have an income beneficiary, they want income, and you have remainder beneficiaries who are going to receive it when the income beneficiary is deceased. They want growth. And so you've always had this conflict on how do you achieve both of those goals. And so the change has been moved, and we have adopted that through the modern portfolio theory of investing under the Uniform Prudent Investor Rule, which was adopted a few years ago here. And the ability to express it as a percentage rather than as traditional income would allow, in most circumstances, more investment opportunities, more growth, and more income. I worked with a charitable trust out of Sitka that was very frustrated with what the local charities were receiving as distributions because of the restrictions on how it had to be invested and how it had to be distributed. And the trustees said, let's see if we can move to this modern portfolio theory, do some total return investing, and use a percentage so that we can perpetuate this for the future of Sitka. It's a Sitka community trust, and also generate more money for these charities. And we went to look at the statute and realized, yes, that's great, and we can do it. We had the ability to do it, but then we restricted the trustees from only looking at it once every 10 years, and you're thinking, why would you do that? We've authorized it, and that's not changed. That's been here since 2003, the ability to do this. But instead, we're saying, yes, you can do it, but you have to look at it only once every 10 years. That didn't seem reasonable. We went to court, and the court agreed that that was not a reasonable limitation. And so as a result, I went back, looked at the Pennsylvania statute, which is where our statute was derived from. They didn't have a 10-year limitation. I looked at the legislative history. I don't know why it was there. But it is not prudent, I believe, and this will allow trustees to look at the investment strategies more often, look at their distributions more often, and respond to the changing circumstances.
Is there any parallel? I mean, this is maybe a little off topic, but I see the word prudent, and I think of the permanent funds sort of prudent investor rule. Is there a parallel between sort of this use of the word prudent and their adoption of the prudent investor rule?
Yes,
same concept.
Same concepts.
I guess right. Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
And I guess, has there been any negative experience under similar types of language that you're aware of? Because I can see under similar types of language, you know, really flows with the stock market. The stock market goes down the tubes and your whole trust is wiped out, potentially. So, it's just a big change, that's all, and I just want everyone to make sure we understand what we're getting ourselves into.
Through the chair, the change to the uni trust and the total return investing is designed to take into account the fact that you could have a fluctuation in the stock market, because you're basing this on the value of the whole trust. And so it will, and you can average it over 3 years, just like the permanent fund averages, I believe, over 5 years. And it's the same concept, is that you're able to go back and you average it over 3 years, and that way you are you're taking into consideration that there are going to be ups and downs in the stock market. I believe it's actually the more prudent way and the better way to protect trust assets than the traditional investing and distribution methods.
And just for the record, I mean, I'm assuming that it still has to be can't be less than 2 and can't be more than 7. You're bounded by those hard numbers here in the statute.
That is correct.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Let's see, where were we? Excuse me. Section 14?
13.
Excuse me, I keep skipping. Section 13, excuse me. This is the value determination, which I just talked about with the averaging over the 3 years. It makes it clear that if the trust has been in existence for less than 3 years, it could be averaged over 2 years if the trustee believed that would be a better rule. Section 14 addresses, it is a court case from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As we all like to say, bad facts make bad law, and this case is one that is very evident. And currently, Alaska has the Uniform Fraudulent Conveyance Laws. You cannot have any intent to defraud your creditors. If you set up a trust with the intent to defraud your creditors, you know, they can come in, they can attack the trust and possibly reach the assets. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said that if you just even express the intent to do asset protection, in this case, putting assets in a trust to protect against the beneficiary's potential future creditors, that could be equivalent to intent to defraud, which doesn't make any sense, and because you don't know about these potential creditors and you logically can't have an intent to defraud a creditor if you don't know about the creditor or even have any reasonable expectation that this creditor would exist in the future. This is just to clarify that expressed intent, which all of us talk about when we discuss trust with our clients, because part of why we do trust is asset protection. Whether it be because...
Finish your sentence, go ahead. I'm listening.
Whether it may be because the individual it has spendthrift problems, has disabilities, has the ability to be taken advantage of, and then that creditor would come in later. So asset protection is done in a variety of contexts, and this is just to make it clear that if one of the purposes that a parent might set up a trust for a child is because they're worried that the child has spendthrift habits and will go out and run up huge credit card bills, they haven't done that yet, then that in and of itself is not an intent to defraud.
Senator Wilikowski.
Can a potential future creditor be also a beneficiary of the trust? And I guess what I'm getting at is, let's say a parent sets up a trust for a child. The child's not considered a future creditor, is he?
Through the chair, no. That he's considered the beneficiary of the trust.
Is there a situation where someone who's a future beneficiary would also be considered a creditor?
Through the chair, not that I'm aware of.
Okay, thank you.
I believe, make sure I'm at, sections 15 is a repeal, and I will be embarrassed and say I didn't bring section 360D to tell you what it's repealing. So let me look real quick.
Ms. Pearson is proving her worth as an aide.
Thank you. Oh, excuse, that is a definition of qualified beneficiary, and it's being replaced by the new definition of qualified beneficiary. So that's why that is being repealed. And then section 16 is the enactment in the indirect court rule change, and that is because of the penalties and potential award of attorney's fees if we have a challenge to one of the trust certifications. And I believe that would be the entire bill. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Chapman, thank you. I don't see any questions right away, but your expertise would be helpful. I'm sure if you could remain in the room, that'd be excellent. Senator Wilikowski.
On the applicability, it says it applies to trust in existence on and after the date. So a trust could be in effect. So basically all trusts come under this. Is that?
Through the chair, that is correct as to some of these sections, right, which are the default, most of which are the default provisions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have four individuals online to testify. Let's go to them now and begin with Jonathan Blockmacher. Mr. Blockmacher, are you there on the telephone?
Senator, I am. Thank you. It's a privilege for me to be before your committee.
You put yourself on record. We'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Well, thank you very much, sir. I participated in the drafting of this. I have the privilege of representing people all around the country, and the vast majority of trusts my clients choose to use are located in Alaska. And this continues to put Alaska in the forefront of having, you know, the best trust system in the country, and I would hope that the committee will approve the bill. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Next up is Linda Holbert. Ms. Holbert, are you there?
Yes. This is Linda Holbert. I'm in Fairbanks, Alaska. I am an agent with New York Life Insurance, and I've lived in Fairbanks 40 years. I've been with New York Life almost 20 years now, and I've had the opportunity to work with the Alaska Trust ideas and legislation. I'd like to support this legislation. It's brought jobs and opportunities for Alaska residents, as well as new jobs and a great deal of money into the state, which makes a lot of other economic development possible. It's been beneficial to my clients, and I've worked with the Alaska Trust concepts with attorneys and trust companies. So I'd like to support this bill, and I thank you for your time.
Ms. Holbert, thank you. Next up is Dave Schaftel. Mr. Schaftel, are you on the line?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I'm a member of the group of attorneys who have worked on this bill, along with Beth Chapman, who really has done the brunt of the work and the leadership and has put together a bill that is very practical for attorneys working in Alaska and for their clients. This bill, both as Beth has described, provides default provisions if these provisions are not already covered in a trust instrument. Sometimes, as she described, the attorney who drafted the document or a person who drafted a document for themselves fails to cover important provisions, and this bill fills in those provisions. Alternatively, there are a number of provisions here which we all could put into all of our trusts, but as you can see from the length of this bill and the thoroughness of these provisions, it would lengthen and make even more complicated our trust instruments. So we can rely on these provisions when we want to as being inserted by our state statutes, and we don't need to cover them in the trust documents. I think this is an excellent bill. It was needed. Beth should be commended for all of her hard work on it, and the staff and legislative counsel who have helped put this together, and highly recommend this bill to the Senate Judiciary Committee for consideration for enactment. Thank you.
Mr. Schaftel, thank you. Let me just ask you one question. Are you aware of anyone who's opposed to the changes that are incorporated in HB 197?
No, I'm not, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir. Other questions for Mr. Schaftel? I don't see any. Next up is Robert Manley. Mr. Manley, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Thank you. My name is Robert Manley. I am a attorney in Anchorage. I practice in the trust and estates area. I support this bill not only because it makes or keeps Alaska as an attractive environment for the situs of trusts that may be funded from outside of Alaska. I think even more importantly, its provisions make it easier and less expensive for Alaskans to carry out their estate plans, and that's why I am supporting the bill. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Manley? I don't see any. Thank you, Mr. Manley. I have one email I received yesterday that I wanted to read into the record. It just seemed a ring of authenticity, and it's from a man named Stephen Greer. Let me just read it. It's fairly short. It says, "My name is Stephen Greer. I'm a sole practitioner whose area of practice is exclusively estate planning. I do not represent any of the trust companies. My typical client is the average working Alaska individual and couple. I am particularly sensitive to the needs and concerns of trust beneficiaries. I would like to express my support for HB 197. This bill, even before its introduction in the House, went through a rigorous discussion and drafting process in which the three competing interests, settlors, trustees, and beneficiaries, were addressed and resolved. The bill represents a compromise between those interests and is an improvement over existing law. Even though I am not able to attend telephonically, if you have any questions, I'll be more than happy to answer any questions which a member might have. I wrote back to Mr. Greer, told him I'd make that a part of the record, and so I wanted to just give an opportunity to read that into the record. Other questions or comments or discussion about the bill? Senator Terry.
Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Greer, a number of years back when we were just getting started on this, was very instrumental in the package of law, trust laws that passed at that time. In fact, as part of the statewide group that looks at that, he was tasked to come down here and participate. So I was glad to see that he's still involved.
Appreciate that bit of history. Other comments or questions? This is the only committee to which the bill has been referred to in the Senate side. And for that reason, I'm going to hold it over to a future hearing next week. We'll move the bill. My anticipation and expectation is that the bill will move out next week. But because we're the only committee, I think we'll just hold on to it and let it settle in a little bit more in our consciousness. It looks like a very tightly and well-done piece of legislation. Other questions, comments, concerns, or issues to come before the committee? Then, if not, we are adjourned. Thank you.